White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, listeners and students of the International Jew. This is December 20th, 2012, and I'm Carolyn Yeager here with Hadding Scott.
Hello.
Hello, Hadding, and season's greetings to you, Hadding.
Well, thank you. It is almost winter, isn't it?
Yes, right?
Almost.
Well,
solstice.
It is. I mean, this is. Today's the 20th. I don't know if the solstice is tonight. The solstice night is considered to be tonight or tomorrow. Night.
I believe it's in the morning.
Okay, so this is the eve of it. So as I was driving home, I had to go into town today. I had a busy day, and I got home kind of late, and I was thinking, well, is this, then it hit me. I thought, well, this is it. This is the shortest day, or tomorrow might be shorter, but anyway, this might be the solstice night. So happy solstice to you, Hadding, and happy solstice to all you listeners. Yeah, this is our solstice program. And I'm going to have to say a few things here that I normally wouldn't say on this program, because we don't have that much time. But I won't be on the air on, I won't have a program Monday, as I've said so many times now, you're probably tired of hearing me saying that. But there will not be a new program on Monday, Christmas Eve. But I want to tell the listeners that Santa has been, we don't have too many listeners right at the moment. Santa has been visiting me, and I'm starting to feel like I'm getting something. And I actually received a present from a listener in the mail, a beautiful book. And I've already thanked him and written to him. But I want to thank Craig in Mississippi, who sent a nice little note I got the other day and had a little money in it. And but I don't have an email address for him, so I have to thank him on the air. And then Carl and Paul, I've heard from, who've sent me donations personally, and we'll see how it goes. I think there's been some others, but I think I already mentioned them on the air. I also want you all to know that Hadding and I will be back next Thursday. We're not going to be missing any programs because of Christmas and New Year. And tonight, if you don't have anything you want to say, Hadding, we are going to start. I'm very excited about this with volume 2, and I think these are going to be some really interesting articles.
Okay. Okay. All right. There's a preface at the beginning of the second volume. Preface: a former volume containing the first 20 articles in this series of Jewish studies, which began their appearance in the Dearborn Independent of May 22, 1920, dealt largely with the theory of the Jewish world program. The present volume gives a general view of some of the evidence which illustrates and substantiates that program. As the first volume brought the subject forward a step, the present volume brings it forward another step. The question is a very big one. The material is of mountainous proportions, so that it is very desirable that there be simplicity of method. The method, therefore, has been to lay the observable everyday facts alongside the program to see if they agree. It will be time enough to take up the authenticity of the protocols when the parallel between them and the activities of the Jewish leaders is shown.
Oh, what do you think about that? So they're still going to talk about that. They haven't even discussed that yet, he says. That's coming up somewhere.
I think a more sound procedure would have been to proceed from observation and not worry about what the protocols say so much.
Well, that's what they're doing.
They're doing it now, we're observing,
and then we'll see if it fits with the protocols, and then we'll look at it.
But, you know, somebody can accuse them of confirmation bias.
True, I guess.
Yeah. The articles thus far printed remain unanswered. They have been denounced and misrepresented, but not answered. A favorite evasion of Jewish editors is to say that the statements made about the Jews could be made about any other race, and that no race could refute the statements with facts. But these statements have not been made without any other, have not been made about any other race, and could they be? If they were made about, say, the Hungarians, Poles, Romanians, Italians, English, Scotch, Irish, Russian, or Syrian in our midst, could they not be met? Not the mere fact that certain statements are made about the purposes of Jewish leaders, but the fact that people can see wherein the statements agree with the actual conditions is what gives strength to the statements. The same statements made about any other group would fall because the people could find nothing to sustain them. Say-so and hearsay have no weight at all. Neither has abuse or prejudice. If the statements made in these articles are false, they are of a nature which can be refuted with facts. If there is no parallel between the written program of the protocols and the actual program as followed under Jewish leadership, surely that can be shown. If it has not been shown, it is because the parallel exists and Jewish leaders know it exists. The following chapters take up numerous matters, chiefly the interference of the Jew with educational and religious interests of the majority of the people, the moral menace in the Jew-controlled theater and movie, the fight of the New York Stock Exchange against Jewish domination, a discussion of the question whether the Jews are a religious denomination or a race, only Jewish authorities being quoted, and a very slight beginning on the endless subject of Jewish influence during the Great War, which is what they used to call World War I.
Yes.
Bernard M. Baruch, although secondary in the real Jewish councils, proclaimed himself to a congressional committee as the most powerful man in the war.
Wow.
And the records show that he was.
Now, I got here a little note for me. Oh, I already mentioned this to you. Woodrow Wilson's failing is he's such a failure as a president, and he's the typical liberal academic weakling of a man, the wrong sort of person to ever have as a leader.
Well, we've had a string of such weaklings.
He was the first.
There was a chapter earlier that talked about how the Jews like to, I don't remember exactly how he put it, but if there's a man in politics that has a skeleton in his closet, that skeleton in his closet provides a handle whereby he can be controlled. You know, he has to keep that thing secret, and he can be blackmailed and so forth. Woodrow Wilson was like that. He had an illegitimate child. And this was a secret, but his widow wanted $40,000, and Samuel Untermyer helped him out with that. Of course, in exchange,
he couldn't find $40,000 from a non-Jew. He had to go to the Jews.
Well, you know, it was a secret, and he would have had to reveal his secret, I suppose.
See, that's exactly what they say in the protocols, how they work, Hattie.
Yeah.
You know, and I was saying the other night that that they prey on human weaknesses. They prey on human weakness. That's what they do. You can always find them. You know, everybody's got them. So this all has to be exposed. But anyway,
and Wilson also wasn't quite right in the head, at least toward the end of his life. I'm not sure if this is a theory or if it's a substantiated whatsoever, but supposedly he had a series of small strokes that affected the functioning of his mind.
His wife was the president.
Yeah, supposedly toward the end his wife was running the country.
Yeah, right.
Supposedly.
Well, he messed up big time. And I mean, that's, instead of leaving him there in the panoply of presidents, you know, as though he was just as good. He should be brought down. His picture ought to be taken down.
But you see, a lot of those other guys are no better.
Well, we can start with him, right? And then we can go on to the rest.
We have had so many presidents.
he was particularly bad, and then that we got into that Great War. That was the beginning of everything that's so terrible.
We've had so many presidents that had health problems. I mean, like Franklin Roosevelt, he was
wheelchair bound.
You know, to what extent was he sinister, and to what extent was he just malleable?
Yeah.
It's hard to say. You know, and we had Bill Clinton that would just have sex with any female that offered herself, apparently, and he was obviously not that hard to pressure.
None of these people quite measure up to what Woodrow Wilson did.
You know.
And not that I think he intended to. He just was a total weakling.
That's what we usually get.
Yeah.
Do you think Barack Obama is is he a man of his own mind? You know, I just
we'll have to do a program on that. We'll have to plan a program for a Saturday afternoon program in January talking about the presidents. So
W. Bush, he was a drunkard.
Yeah.
I mean,
you're right. We could go through that whole thing.
Anymore, but an alcoholic alcoholism is for life. The alcoholic personality doesn't go away.
I'm glad you appreciate the problems of alcohol. Not everybody does, you know. But it is an insidious thing. Truly it is. These women were not so far off when they wanted to prohibition? That was the alcohol thing. You know, but
the real problem is people that are born with the predilection for that problem, because there's a whole personality syndrome that goes with it.
Well, I know, and there's a lot of them too. And if they're born with it, it's kind of tough. Well, let's go on, or we won't.
All right, concluding paragraph of the preface. This volume does not complete the case. It is issued to meet the demand of new readers who call for the articles from the beginning. The editions of the Dearborn Independent being long ago exhausted, the publication of these two volumes was undertaken to enable readers to begin with the first article. The omission of several articles from this compilation is in the interest of compactness and may be restored in another volume. The omitted articles are The Jews' Complaint Against Americanism, October 23rd, Gentile Fall Involved in Hope of Jewish Rule, December 25th.
Well, this one is just April. He wrote this in April 19.
Yeah, the preface is dated April 1921.
Yeah, so anyway, that's a ways away yet. But it's interesting that they left two of the articles out of the volume. I guess it was just too long or something. Too many chapters. Okay, now we have this quote by Leo N. Levy, president of B'nai B'rith.
Yeah, why don't you read that? I'm going to have to do a lot of voices tonight.
All right, I'll just read it normally. The distinctive character of the Jew, and this is Levy, does not arise solely from his religion. It is true that his race and religion are indissolubly connected. Indissolubly. Well, I have trouble in that.
Indissolubly connected.
Yes. But whatever be the cause of this juncture of the race idea with the religion, it is very certain that the religion alone does not constitute the people. A believer in the Jewish faith does not, by reason of that fact, become a Jew. On the other hand, however, a Jew by birth remains a Jew, even though he abjures his religion. Now, this is Levi, President Levy, president of B'nai B'rith, from 1900 to 1904.
Leo N. Levy, or Levi.
Yeah. So, and the Jews all say that, but this is going to be an interesting chapter about...
Here we go, chapter 21. Oh. How Jews in the U.S. conceal their strength. How many Jews are there in the United States? No Gentile knows. The figures are the exclusive property of the Jewish authorities. The government of the United States can provide statistics on almost every matter pertaining to the population of the country. But whenever it has attempted in a systematic way to get information about the Jews who are constantly entering the country, and the number now resident here, The Jewish lobby at Washington steps in and stops it. I was interested in the fact that they were already referring to a Jewish lobby back then.
Yeah, I mean, this is the point that people should be aware of, that, man, they were strong. But then it was 1920 already. We know, you know, how early they started. But, you know, their main immigration was between, like, from 1880 on. So it didn't take them long to get so strong. Yeah.
For more than 20 years, the fight for the right of the United States government to make a complete census of the people has been going on. And for the same period, the Jewish lobby at the Capitol has been strong enough to win. The alarming increase in Jewish immigration at the present time has brought the question to public attention again. For the first time in the history of the United States, a national conviction is forming upon this subject. From Europe came the first news which startled this country. The reports told of vast mobilizations of Jewish people at stated rendezvous in Europe. Great barracks were built for them. Large bodies of trained men went from the United States under orders of Jewish secret societies here to expedite passport work, as it is termed among these bodies. Immigration into the United States became a business, a strictly Jewish business. Why is that statement made, a strictly Jewish business? For this reason, there are countries in Europe from which today no Gentile can be admitted to the United States. From Germany, from Russia, from Poland, it is with the utmost difficulty that even one person can be won permission to enter this country. But Jews from Poland, Germany, and Russia by the thousands come in most freely, in utter disregard of the laws, in open contempt of the health regulations. A strictly Jewish business of getting another million Jews into the United States. It is like moving an army which, having done duty in Europe for the subjugation of that continent, is now being transferred to America.
Is this a result of the Great War, that these people from Germany, Russia, and Poland were not wanted, but the Jews from no matter where were allowed in?
Well,
is that,
you know,
already
there was
in the... Go ahead.
There was that story about the 6 million Jews that could perish.
Yeah, right. Right, they were already screaming about the suffering Jews in Russia and in Eastern Europe and somewhere, and even in Europe. And so you think that's why they were allowing all these Jews to come?
Well, yeah, evidently they took the occasion of the war and the effects of the war to claim that there was a humanitarian crisis and that Jews needed to be allowed to... Never mind the rest of the people there, they just have to suffer, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
When the conditions overseas were made known in this country and it became apparent that Jewish societies in the United States were the principal aids in this stampede to America, the newspapers for the first time in American history began to comment on a Jewish question in tones of alarm. This in itself is an indication that the facts are becoming too challenging to be longer ignored. Even the ordinary immigration officials, who for years have watched the human stream as it flowed over Ellis Island, have this year been startled into attention and action by the sharp change that has come in the character of the stream. And what has startled them? First, it is composed almost entirely of Jews. Real Ukrainians, real Russians, real Germans cannot come in, but Jews can come from anywhere, and are coming from almost anywhere.
Everywhere.
Why this special privilege is being asked? Second, they do not come as refugees, as people fleeing from hunger and persecution. They come as if they own the country. They arrive as special guests. As on the other side, the passport business is arranged, so on this side, the entrance business is arranged. The laws are set aside. health regulations are ignored. Why should they not behave as if they own the United States? They see officials of Jewish secret societies override officials of the United States Immigration Bureau. Their first glimpse of life here shows a Jewish control as potent and complete as it is in Russia. No wonder, then, that they literally beat down the walls and gates with all the éclat of a victorious invasion. Is not this America the Jews' country, as it is called in the smaller nations of Europe?
You know, I bet most Americans would be just have no idea that this kind of thing was going on, you know, and how these Jews just got their way all the time. Instead of being persecuted and mistreated, they got what they wanted all the time.
Well, he says that the newspapers started to take note of it, finally. And they actually did change the immigration laws right about the time that this was published.
Well, that's okay.
For the most part, to limit Jewish immigration, which the Jews complained about bitterly. It didn't completely shut out Jews. It just limited immigrants to the proportions that they already had within the country. It didn't, in other words, if there were only... if only 1% of the population was from Russia, then only 1% of all immigrants each year could be from Russia.
Yeah.
Which put a big pinch on the Jews there, which they
finally
did not like.
Right.
Third,
the fact that the United States became so Jewish, and I mean the fact there's more Jews in the United States than there is in Israel, so there's more Jews in the U.S. than anywhere else in the world. So the fact that it's become, you know, the home of Jews and a Jewish nation and so on, was planned out by them way back then. You know, they wanted to come here and make it Jewish. And somebody further along here brags that there's more Jews in New York City than any other city in the world or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Third, there is a perfect organization which overcomes the numerous objections which arise against admission of known revolutionary Jews. European Jews are potential revolutionists. They are the revolutionists of Italy, Germany, Russia, and Poland today. They are the Red and IWW leaders of the United States today. When one man whose record is known presents himself at Ellis Island, and of course he is one in a thousand whose records are not known, he is held up. Immediately there start across the country telegrams to congressmen, editors, state and municipal officials, telling them in peremptory tones to get busy in behalf of Mr. So-and-so who is detained at Ellis Island. And the same day, there start back to Washington telegrams from congressmen, editors, and others of influence, insisting on the spotless character of Mr. So-and-so and demanding his immediate admittance into the United States. Sometimes also the Russian embassy, so-called, is used in this work. It is an invasion. Nothing but an invasion, and it is helped by influences within the United States. It is thinly cloaked with sentiment. These people are fleeing from persecution. It is cleverly assisted by photographs showing groups of forlorn-looking women and children. Never by photographs showing the groups of husky young revolutionists who are just as ready to despoil the United States as they were to despoil Russia.
That's the same way they do with the Holocaust and the photographs they use. They never want to show you all those healthy camp inmates.
Yeah. Well, there were lots of healthy ones, too.
Oh, yeah, there were.
That, however, is the present situation. What this and a subsequent article propose to do for the reader is to put him in possession of some of the facts concerning the government's fight on this question during the last quarter century. The question is not peculiar to America, and it may throw a sidelight on the American phase to note some of the facts developed at the hearings of the British Royal Commission on Alien Immigration, which sat in London in 1902, a feature of whose proceedings was the testimony of Theodor Herzl, the great propagandist of Zionism. In his initial statement to the commission, Herzl made these statements, among others. The fact that there is now for the first time since Cromwell a perceptible number of our people in England is the true cause of this commission being called together. That a serious pressure exists in England, the fact of your commission sitting is full proof.
You see, now, I noticed when I read this that he has no apologies, he has no fear, he has no qualms about talking about our people, and that our people cause other peoples in countries, say, such as England, discomfort and nervousness, and, you know, they got to look into it. But that doesn't bother him at all. You know, he was an excellent representative because he spoke kind of truthfully, but he didn't apologize for it either.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he was trying to get a Jewish state established, and part of his argument was that the Jews needed a Jewish state because it was the answer to friction with other nations.
That's right. That's
so right. He would admit that there was this friction.
Do you think that would you have the opinion that Herzl was sincere about his thoughts at the time that Jews should separate from the other peoples into their own nation, or is that just a setup as it's turned out to be?
Well, I haven't read his book, so I can't really comment on it. I mean, some people. Oh, jeez. I don't know. Are Jews ever sincere about anything?
Yeah, that's it. You know, I mean, I don't think so, but I would, you know, I wonder if maybe he kind of was. He thought that was the answer, or if it was all just a big
Supposedly Herzl was in favor of accepting Uganda as a Jewish state.
Yeah, as a start. He said we can start there, and then we can keep working for what we really want. He thought it was wrong to turn down that offer. I know that part of it. Okay, well.
Okay.
He's an interesting guy.
Then the examination proceeded until the following was brought out. The answers are Herzl's. Question. Looking at the question of alien immigration from the standpoint of the United States for a moment, you have referred to the fact that America excludes. Answer. Yes. Question. The exclusion is a partial exclusion? Answer. Exclusion, as I know, is worked in this way. The immigrant must show a certain amount of money at the moment of his landing. Question. You are aware that the stream of immigration into the United States is twice as much as the immigration into the United Kingdom? Answer. I know that. New York has now the greatest Jewish population of all the towns in the world. Question. And the actual exclusion is the actual exclusion of a small proportion? Answer. Yes, but they go, however, to America. I think it is so easy to evade such a prohibition. For instance, if they joined a small company, it would lend the necessary amount to each immigrant, and the immigrant shows it and comes in, and sends back by post the amount he has borrowed. There are no efficacious measures to prevent that. Question. I took it that your reference to the United States was an approval of the action of that country as an act of self-preservation. Answer. No. A little later on in the examination, the question of immigration to the United States was again brought in. The answers are still Dr. Herzl's. Remember that the date is still 1902. Question. Are you aware, whether it is the fact or not, that the leading Jews in America have informed their correspondents here that they cannot receive and distribute any more Jewish immigrants? Answer. I have heard of difficulties of emigration and that they are overcrowded with Jews. As to that information, I cannot say. Question. In your opinion, would not the stream of emigration to America have been much greater if no such law had existed? Answer.
I think this law did not alter it much. The prohibition could not change it. Question. On what grounds do you believe that? Answer. It is a question of coasts and harbors. They come in. How will you prevent a man from coming in? Question. Do you believe that they are smuggled in? Answer. No, I do not believe that, but they always find means to come in. Now, discussion of immigration in the United States has never been free. Discussion of immigration in the United States has never been free. We have talked a great deal about it in general terms, but not in terms of specific races except the Chinese and Japanese. He means historically. There was a lot of discussion about Asian exclusion. However, Herzl seems to have known that wherever the Jews congregate in noticeable numbers, they become a trouble. His words are, America, where so soon as they form a perceptible number, they become a trouble and a burden to the land. And he also knew that efforts would be made to meet that condition. But more than that, he dropped what must be construed as a warning that such efforts would be resisted. He said, there exists a French proverb, cet animal est très impatient, il se défend quand on l'attaque. If the Jews attacked, they will defend themselves, and you will get something like internal troubles.
See, this is what we need to do. We need to take this kind of thinking. You know, we need to see ourselves as a persecuted group like they did and still want to pretend like they are, and that we're being attacked, and we need to defend ourselves and give them trouble. Well,
the time apparently did come in the United States when some far-seeing official began to wonder what the Jewish invasion portended. Already it was too strong to be openly attacked. The Jewish lobby at Washington was powerful even at that time, so apparently this official concluded that the best way to set about so momentous a task was to collect the information.
So that was 1902, Hadding, right? We're still talking about 1902. Already the Jewish power was too strong to be openly attacked.
Well, see, that thing from 1902, that was in the U.K.,
I know, but you know, it's just amazing. And when I thought about it, it's because of money. That gold, you know, the gold. They had all the money already all tied up. They had all that, financial pressure, like to the press. They could, you know, use their advertising, all that Jewish advertising. They were involved in so much, and the more money they had, the more money they were able to make and to grow in their financial power. So. And they had no, you know, they have no sense of proportion. They'll go as far as they can go. And they don't feel like they have to just, you know, take one part of things and leave something for someone else. They just will grab up everything they can get and keep going.
Yeah. The Jew knows no moderation.
No, I
guess I don't know
not.
Who said that, but I think somebody said something like that.
Not in business.
Yeah. But in order to get the information, Congress had to give its permission, and to get the permission of Congress, hearings had to be ordered. Hearings were ordered, and the records of them, though very scarce, still exist. The reader will be given important extracts from them presently, and he will see for himself how certain American statesmen reacted to the whole matter. A remark is in order just here. Namely, that the Jewish lobby eventually became more skillful in such matters. It now takes very good care that no officials shall be appointed who shall make suggestions which shall precipitate congressional hearings on the Jewish matter. The time is coming, of course, when the whole Jewish question may be threshed out by the government of the United States, but it will not be because an official precipitated it. It will be because the people will demand it.
You know, I have to say that Ford and his group expected more of the American people than they actually gave, you know, lived up to. They thought the people would really respond to all this, and they found, and I think when Ford gave up, you know, he didn't initiate any court case, but when he agreed to settle the second time around or whatever.
1927, you mean?
Yeah, it's because he knew that the people weren't behind him. They weren't going to be that this whole slanderous anti-Semitism thing, you know, worked on the people. And so he wasn't going to be ruined over it.
Well, that 1927, that was about the protocols specifically?
Well, no, because that guy's who brought the wasn't really the official jury who brought that case against
Lewis Marshall, wasn't it?
No, Lewis Marshall was the one who wrote out the settlement and everything. But he wasn't behind it. He didn't even like the fact that this one Jew was bringing this case against Ford. It was this guy who had his own personal gripe, you know, about something, and he was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you have that whole part of it clear.
No, I haven't looked into that very much.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this, you know, they're always saying in the International Jew, the people of the American people will be the ones who will demand this. Well, they didn't. We didn't, did we? I mean, I wasn't there.
Well, you see, the thing is, obviously people think that their work is going to have an effect or they won't do it.
Yeah.
Right? You have to have that optimism. I heard Jared Taylor in an interview a few days ago say that he thought by now there would have been a momentous change of attitude about race in the United States as a result of his work, which he started, I think, a couple decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it hasn't happened.
That's right.
But it doesn't mean that the work hasn't had any effect. You know,
well,
I mean,
this has an effect. You have a certain amount of followers, but in the big picture, they're tiny little nothing. You know. They don't amount to anything.
People can refer to the fact that Henry Ford, the great industrialist, was on to the Jews, and it gives a certain conditional respectability to the whole thing. It's flawed by the fact that they talk about the protocols so much, but
I'm not faulting Ford. I mean, I agree that his work has been very important, very helpful. And all of that, but I just mean that to expect that so many have expected, and the people are still saying that today. They're expecting when certain conditions are met, American people are, you know, or the people or something are going to rise up. And well, you know, they have been pushing these. It's like the debt ceiling. They've been pushing these conditions that are going to have to be met beyond and beyond and beyond, because the people still don't rise up. And I don't believe that that's ever going to happen.
Well, you can't just rely on the disorganized masses of people.
No, you can't. And
you have to have an organization. You have to have an organization.
That's it. And even Hitler didn't depend on the people rising up, and they didn't. He had an organization, and he showed that people should turn to him and his organization. And over a period of time, he succeeded in that. But he wasn't saying, well, when things get bad enough, the people are going to really, you know, take over for themselves.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah. Somebody
and the people aren't even going to stop the Jews, no matter what the Jews are doing, because they're going to tell themselves, oh, well, you know, they're going to believe what they're told in the press. They're going to go along with the idea that we can't be anti-Semitic and it's not really the Jews and blah, blah, all that, you know, they always do. So that's just my comment.
Well, the disorganized masses don't do anything. It's organized minorities that make changes.
Yeah.
Officials are now much too wary to meddle with this question. They know too well the consequences. During the war, many a secret trail of danger led into Jewish quarters, and the Secret Service man who loyally made his reports was often surprised to find himself lifted completely off that trail. Why? All Jewish trails in this country were powerfully protected by hidden influences during the war. Well, the time came in the United States when it was obviously desirable to know what elements were comprising our population, whether we were an Anglo-Saxon nation, Semitic, Latin, or what. The situation was this, and was so stated by government officials at the time. In the 80s and previously, it could be safely assumed that an immigrant from Ireland was Irish, an immigrant from Norway or Sweden was Scandinavian, an immigrant from Russia was Russian, an immigrant from Germany was German, and so on. But times changed. Previous to 1880, the entry on a man's record, born in Russia, indicated that he was a Russian. But, says a statement made by a government official with reference to the 10 years following 1880, so many Hebrews have come from that country to the United States that born in Russia has come in popular opinion to mean a Russian Jew. And then the same official goes on to show that during a 10-year period when 666,561 Jews came from Russia, there came also from Russia large numbers of Poles, Finns, Germans, and Lithuanians from Russia. Now, to make a census enumeration of these peoples under the heading Russian was plainly misleading, and not only misleading, but valueless for census purposes. The racial identity would be lost, and our knowledge of the racial makeup of the nation very incomplete. Therefore, the census authorities asked Congress for permission to classify people by race as well as by country of birth. It seemed perfectly reasonable. Of what possible use is it to classify 3 million Jews as Russians when there are very few real Russians in the country, and when the Russian and the Jew are so deeply different one from another? Senator Guggenheim arose in the committee to object. He used the common formula in such cases. He said, "Personally, I object to it not because I am a Hebrew, but because it is not in place."
Yeah, a liar.
Claiming it was inappropriate. Right. That is the common Jewish formula of objection. The B'nai B'rith says the same thing when it forces Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice out of the public schools, that society's anti-defamation circular always includes the thought, "We do not base our request on the embarrassment which may be caused to the Jewish students in class, nor is our attitude in this regard based on thin-skinned sensitiveness. Our objection is made because of the effect upon the non-Jewish children, who subconsciously will associate in their minds the Jew as Shakespeare portrayed him with the Jew of today." So Senator Guggenheim, therefore, was playing the game according to the rules made and established in such cases. At this hearing, Senator La Follette was chairman. Senator Guggenheim's contention was that Jew was the name of a member of a religious denomination and not of a race. Chairman La Follette, "I can see broad ethnological reasons why sometime it would be important to know from what blood and race the man came." Senator Guggenheim, "Why not ask his religion?" Senators McCumber and Bailey came to the support of Senator Guggenheim's contention that Jew is a religion and not a racial term, a religious and not a racial term. Chairman La Follette, "I do not just get your objection to this, Senator Guggenheim. What objection can one have to having the race to which he belongs correctly entered?" Senator Guggenheim, "Because it is not correct when stated that way. The Jews are not a race." Later on in the hearing, Senator Cummins entered the discussion in response to a pro-Jewish remark made by Senator Bailey. Senator Bailey, if I were a Jew and I had been born here and they wanted me to say I was anything but an American, I would have a difference with the enumerator. I perhaps would refuse to answer their questions. Senator Cummins, I would not have any hesitancy in stating from what blood I was. Senator Bailey, no, but in the case that I referred to, it would be a matter of religion. Senator Guggenheim, that is the point. It is a question of religion. That was in April 1909. In December 1909, Simon Wolfe was the chief witness for the pro-Jewish contention. Simon Wolfe is a very interesting character. From before the days of President Lincoln, he has been lobbyist for the Jews at the National Capitol and has been in contact with every president from Lincoln to Wilson. At the hearing where Mr. Wolfe testified, Senator Dillingham acted as chairman, and the whole proceeding was enlivened and clarified by the vigorous part which Senator Lodge took in it. Certain extracts, which entirely reproduce the spirit and argument of the hearing, follow. Mr. Wolfe, the point we make is this. A Jew coming from Russia is a Russian, from Romania a Romanian, from France a Frenchman, from England an Englishman, and from Germany a German. That Hebrew or Jewish is simply a religion. Senator Lodge, do I understand you to deny that the Jews are a race? Mr. Wolfe, how? Senator Lodge, do you deny that the word Jew is used to express a race? Mr. Wolfe, as the representative of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, which I have been for nearly 30 years, I took up the matter and propounded a series of interrogations to some of the leading Jews of the United States, among others, Dr. Cyrus Adler, who was a librarian of the Smithsonian. He was the librarian of the Smithsonian. And every one of them states that the Jews are not a race. Senator Lodge, that, I think, is an important point. I have always supposed that they were. I find in the preface of the Jewish Encyclopedia, which is signed by Cyrus Adler, among others, this statement, quote, an even more delicate problem that presented itself at the very outset was the attitude to be observed by the encyclopedia in regard to those Jews who, while born within the Jewish community, have for one reason or another abandoned it. As the present work deals with the Jews as a race, it was found impossible to exclude those who were of that race, whatever their religious affiliations might have been, close quote. In the same encyclopedia is a statement by Joseph Jacobs, B.A., formerly president of the Jewish Historical Society of England. Quote, anthropologically considered, the Jews are a race of markedly uniform type, due either to unity of race or to similarity of environment, close quote. Do you mean to deny, I want to understand your position, that the word Jew is a racial term? Mr. Wolfe, I have made my statement and my opinions are in this pamphlet. Senator Lodge, let me get at it. How would you classify Benjamin Disraeli? Was he a Jew? Mr. Wolfe, he was born a Jew. Senator Lodge, he was baptized as a Christian. He then ceased to be a Jew. Mr. Wolfe, yes, he ceased to be a Jew. Senator Lodge, ah, religiously, he was very proud of the fact that he was a Jew and always spoke of himself in that way. Did the fact that he changed his religion alter his race? Mr. Wolfe, it did not change the fact that he was born a Jew, not at all. And I know that the Jewish people throughout the world have claimed him, Heine and Born, and others who were born of their blood as being Jews when they speak of persons who have accomplished something wonderful in the world. But they cease to be Jews from the standpoint of religion. Senator Lodge, undoubtedly. What I want to get at is whether the word Jew or Hebrew is not a correct racial term. Mr. Wolfe, if you will pardon me, you will find a letter from Dr. Cyrus Adler right at the close of the pamphlet, which perhaps you might read for the benefit of the committee. Senator Lodge, after the reading the letter referred to. I do not think that answers anything. Senator Lodge,
It never occurred to me until I heard you were coming here that the classification as made by the immigration authorities had anything to do with religion. I supposed it was a race classification. It is important, very important, to get the race classification as nearly as we can. Mr. Wolf, you are aware that the Census Bureau some time ago attempted to classify in the same manner, and it was prohibited from doing so. Senator Lodge, the word race was stricken out of the census bill. I think it was a great mistake. It makes the returns almost valueless. Mr. Wolf, I can simply repeat what I have said, that I am voicing the opinions of those whom I represent, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations and the Order of B'nai B'rith. They are opposed to the classification as made in the last few years and as contemplated, so far as I am informed in the report of the commission. The hearings continued, Julian W. Mack later appearing for the Jewish contention. From the extracts given in this article, four matters become very clear. First, the Jew is opposed to any restrictive legislation against his entrance into the country, into any country. Second, the Jew is opposed to any racial classification of himself after he has entered a country. After he has entered a country. Third, the Jewish argument to the Gentile authorities is that the Jew represents religion and not race. Fourth, that at least one indication has appeared in which the Jew has one view to present to the Gentiles and another which he cherishes among his own people on this question of race.
Well, you know, I mean, he admits that, that they consider themselves a race and a religion, but they just come right out and insist on religion when it's convenient for them.
Yes, they do.
As you've mentioned before. And then when otherwise, they talk to each other, basically, about being a race because they want that cohesiveness. And we, like Lodge, did a good job, but he was still trying to be polite and so on, like white people do. And he didn't, you know, attack that guy like he should have for his bad logic.
Oh, yeah. So many times I've run into that. I'm not Jewish, but members of my family are. Which members? Well, my mother and my father. Okay.
Yeah.
Another point may be made as this. When the authorities disregard as untenable the argument of religion, not race, the Jewish spokesmen fall back on the fact that their organizations don't want certain things and won't have certain things. Argument or no argument, commission or no commission.
Now, that's very important. I don't want to keep interrupting because we're almost out of time, but that's very important. They just come down, they just fall back on, well, we just won't have it this way. That's all there is to it. And, you know, they get away with that.
Yeah.
That's what Jewish lobbyists,
the Jewish lobbyists had their way. There is no enumeration of Jews in the United States. There are 46 other classifications, but none for the Jew. The Northern Italians are distinguished in the records from the Southern Italians. The Moravians are distinguished from the Bohemians, the Scotch from the English, the Spanish American from the Spanish European, the West Indians from the Mexicans, but the Jew is not distinguished at all. None of the other races made objection. On this point, the report of the commission reads, as far as ascertained by the commission, the practice of classifying the foreign-born by race or people rather than by country of birth is acceptable to the people of the United States with one exception. The officials who were endeavoring to have the census report show with scientific accuracy the actual racial components of the population of the United States were compelled to see their recommendation eliminated. What is the result? If you ask the government of the United States how many Frenchmen there are in the country, it can give you the figures. If you ask for the number of Poles, it is there. If you ask for the number of Africans, it is known. Or down a long list, you may make your inquiries and you will find that the government knows. But ask the government of the United States how many Jews are in the country and it cannot tell. There are no records.
If you want information upon that point, you will have to go to the officials or representatives of the Jewish government in the United States. Of course, if Jew is a religious term, like Baptist, Catholic, Christian Scientist, or Quaker, then there is merit in the argument that religious questions are not proper for the government to ask unless the religion comes in conflict with or is a menace to the ideals of the Republic. But if Jew is a racial term or a national term, then the government is properly interested in making record of all the inhabitants of this land who bear it. Like all questions pertaining to the Jews, this can be settled by their own words. What the Jews teach the Jews on this matter should be the determining point. In the next article, we shall see what Jews themselves have to say about race or religion.
All right. That's very good reading, Hadding. And, you know, we know what they're going to have to say. We know what that next chapter is going to be, basically. You know, that we know that they call themselves a race amongst themselves, and very much so. And how many quotes do we have by prominent Jews of every stripe who have come out right out and said, Jewish people are a race? You know, I mean, they come right out with it, but yet they get away with these silly arguments.
Well, there's some complication about it, because the word race actually has a range of meanings. If you try to pigeonhole them into one of what are called the major races of mankind, you know, Caucasian, Caucasoid, Negroid, Australoid, Mongoloid, Amerind, I think, used to be considered one, not sure if it still is. They don't fit into any one of those, really. If you have to try to force them into one, most European Jews, you would have to say, well, they seem to fit the Caucasoid category more than others. But that's a very crude racial classification. And if you bear in mind that the word race has more than one meaning, for example, if you look at some 19th century texts, for example, translation of Aeschylus' the Oresteia trilogy, the family of the ruling family of Mycenae is called the race of Atreus. In other words, a particular family, a particular stock, a particular gene pool can be called a race. Yeah. That's a use of the word that we're not used to using today, but it has some relevance, because the descendants of a particular person may very well have certain characteristics in common, even though they may overlap the conventional racial boundaries.
Yes, that's true. Well, you know, sometimes I think we should have more time for this program, Hattie. Like, maybe we should increase it to an hour and a half. I don't know. But we'll think about it. One more correction that I just remembered from last program I was on. I mentioned John from London and his Christmas card. But, you know, it wasn't a Christmas card. It was a solstice card. And I noticed that. I thought, well, you know, if somebody particularly picks out solstice cards, you shouldn't call it a Christmas card. See, if I see something with candles on it at Christmas time, I think it's a Christmas card.
So yeah, he probably went out of the way not to make a Christmas.
That's right. He made it he's a solstice believer. So anyway, we've got 10 seconds. Well, ladies and gentlemen, happy solstice to you from Hadding and I. And we will be back next Thursday. What?
Hadding and me. From Hadding.
Hadding and me. That's right. You're right. Good night.
Bye.
I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.